Jacksonville's mask mandate is lifted. COVID-19 vaccine eligibility will expand significantly next week, and the launch of new relief efforts for Duval residents in need. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Charles Griggs, sitting in for Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, all the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. The number to call is 549-2937. Then later, a world-renowned violinist visits the First Coast. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a very busy news week, we welcome David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union.
Good morning, Charles.
Ann Schindler of First Coast News.
Hi, Charles. How are you?
Great. And Mike Mendenhall of the Jack's Daily Record.
Morning, Charles.
Lots to talk about this week. And we'll go to your calls in a moment. But let's begin with Jacksonville's mask mandate, or rather the lack thereof. This week now, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry has lifted Duval County's mask mandate. The question now becomes, what's next? Some area businesses and community cultural organizations are making it clear that masks and social distancing aren't going away anytime soon, and others couldn't get rid of them fast enough. In fact, there's even a controversial new Instagram account dedicated strictly to tracking local businesses that don't require people to wear a mask. David Bauerlein, what are you hearing about the new mask mandate, and how is it impacting businesses across the board so far?
Well, I think the main impact is that previously a business could put a sign up on the door saying you must wear a mask to enter because of a legal requirement imposed on the business. So they no longer can really do that because there is nothing in place at the state or local level that requires a mask to be worn when you go into a business. So that's the main impact. Now it's completely at the discretion of the business owners as far as whether they're going to require a mask or not. They certainly can still require it as a condition of coming in. But it's really now up to the business, and that means they hear directly from customers one way or the other. And over time, that means you're going to have fewer and fewer businesses have this mask mandate because it's now a voluntary thing, and it makes it harder for them to actually put that enforcement in place.
Yeah, and Sheila, do you believe that some of these businesses and individuals who continue to want to practice mask mandates or at least wear masks in public, are they being shunned in some of these places, or with businesses, you know, they don't mind or not, or if they wear masks in their facilities?
Well, I think one thing that removing the mask mandate does is it takes away some of the cover that businesses had to require that of their employees and their customers. It just makes it that much more difficult, I think, for people who are in those frontline jobs like servers and restaurants, you know, to enforce any kind of facial covering. It's been really hard for people who are dependent on tips and relations with their customers in the first place to make demands like wearing a mask. And we've heard a lot about that on this show, in fact, people saying that it's been so hard for them to tell customers that are dismissive or confrontational when you're dependent as a server on that relationship ending well. So it's difficult, I think, for those people to not have the support of either the state or the county any longer in enforcing the mask mandates. But it's also interesting to see that there's this celebratory side, as you mentioned, that Instagram account. You know, it's got a lot of posts, and you'll notice when you look at them, when they'll put up a business that says, you know, no masks required, they're tagged with little, you know, stickers and emojis and stuff that say things like freedom and hooray. And, you know, it obviously people are eager to get rid of the masks. Personally, I actually am not terribly psyched about it. You know, I've kind of learned to appreciate not having people spittling in my face all the time when they're talking to me, but you know, it is going to change. It is going to evolve. And obviously, we're starting to see those steps.
Yeah. In fact, more than 20 cultural organizations, including WJCT Public Media, issued a joint statement saying they will maintain their COVID-19 protocols for the time being. Mike Mendenhall, do you see that this becoming a problem for those businesses that and those organizations that continue to want to practice this?
Charles. I mean, It likely will, like David said, over time. I mean, as you know, as people and you know, customers start to get more comfortable with more businesses not having the mask mandate in place, it is going to become harder for businesses who want to maintain that mask mandate for their employees and their customers to continue to do that. And you know, this week I spoke with the Jack's Chamber, which is pretty much the leading business organization in the city, and you know, their position was that they were pretty much in line with Mayor Curry's overall mask COVID-19 policy, and they said that that businesses should be able to rely on their employees and their customers' comfort level. So there's really not a lot of protection coming out of those types of civic groups, you know, for our local businesses. And I think it's also worth noting that, you know, Mayor Curry, especially early on in the pandemic, you know, kind of he was one of a lot of mayors of major metropolitan areas around Florida that put these mask mandates in place and really kind of went against the grain of what was coming out of Tallahassee at the governor's office.
Yeah, it is worth noting that early on, Mayor Curry would seem to be one of the elected officials, one of the policymakers who, leaders, I should say, who was, pretty strong in his position on the use of mask ordinance or mandates. And it's also worth noting that the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, still recommend people wear masks. We're hearing that from the experts, Dr. David Fauci, and people from health experts from around the country who are still dealing with the pandemic, say that they're encouraging people to continue to remain, cautious in their approach to how we're, even though we have a vaccine out here now. So, David, what do you think that this in this space, how does this impact our overall health conditions as a community as vaccines become available and we see the light at the end of the tunnel as it relates to COVID-19, but people are ready to break free, as we heard earlier. They're tired of being tied down. So this mask mandate being lifted is seen as something, a sign that people can move forward.
Well, I think that's right, Charles. I think in terms of the mayor, he was out front in the early part of the pandemic in terms of putting a lot of restrictions in, really emphasizing testing, ramping up that big time. As far as the mask goes, for a while, he was just encouraged it strongly, but thought it was a voluntary step people should make. And then last summer, he did put the mandate in place and renewed it every 30 days. But, you know, on the other side of it, he has been kind of one of the first big city mayors to go in terms of opening up the beaches last summer after he had put a restriction on place there. So kind of at the forefront here as well in terms of listing the mandatory mask requirement. I look to see something like later this month, they're going to have the big USC, I think it is, Ultimate Fighting Championship title match in Jacksonville. And that's going to be a full house, 15,000 people. People will pay thousands of dollars for a seat at that event. And as far as I know, that is the first full house capacity crowd at any venue in Florida. I could be wrong about that, in an indoor arena. So again, there's a case where Jacksonville's kind of in the forefront in terms of lifting these restrictions. What does it mean for public health? You know, the mask mandate was never a cure-all. It was never billed as a cure-all. It was a way to mitigate against whatever spread the virus was going to do. So we will be watching the positivity rates and the cases over the next few weeks and see how those change. There's a lot of other factors in play, so I don't know if you can just say it's just removing the mask mandate makes a difference one way or the other. But the positivity rate has been between 4 and 5% the last 2 weeks. That's not 10%. That's good, but it's not really as low as you want it to be able to say, okay, the pandemic's over. It's still spreading out there.
Yeah, the health experts are still warning against the spread of the variant, COVID-19 variant. What we've been seeing, though, in recent weeks is people have been coming back to populating restaurants and evening spots, dare we say like nightclubs, and providing themselves with an opportunity to be entertained. They want to be entertained. It'll be interesting to see how that shakes out here in the coming weeks, especially with these large venue events like the one, like the Ultimate Fighting match that's going to go on here. So let's shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit about the vaccine itself. We've been watching, and we know that next week that the eligibility criteria will change to 18 plus here in Duval County and most throughout the state of Florida. And most people are pretty much excited about that because they believe it will open up more opportunity for people to become vaccinated. Ann Schindler, how do you feel about that? Do you see that this is going to make a big difference in mitigating the spread of the virus? And what would you say is the logic behind Governor DeSantis waiting 2 weeks behind the state of Georgia in order to change the eligibility for the vaccine?
Yeah, Charles, I don't know if I can read that on part of the governor. It is surprising to see that Georgia led on that. And they haven't always been at the forefront of, you know, doing aggressive maneuvers on COVID. So I think it's interesting. But yeah, you are seeing people, especially for the Johnson & Johnson, you know, we saw at the pop-up this week, you know, huge lines, people kind of excited about the idea of just one and done for the shot. And I'm also, you know, hearing a lot of people talk about their vaccines. I was at a funeral recently where people were still masking and social distancing, but they were there and everybody was sort of talking about where they were with their shots. You know, a colleague of ours is planning a wedding, and everybody that's going to be in attendance will have had their second shot by the time that rolls around. So people are actually integrating getting the shot into their plans and into their strategies for staying safe. But I agree with David, you know, we're going to have to watch the positivity rates. They have been creeping up at the same time that the mask mandate ends, at the same time that there's spring break and a greater inclination to kind of participate in events. So it's going to be a balance. And like they said, there's these new virus variants are much more contagious and they're much more dangerous. And we're seeing a lot more people, 25 to mid 40s, who are getting this. I think they constitute about 40% of new infections right now.
Yeah. What health experts say is the virus pretty much, because older people are becoming vaccinated, it almost has nowhere else to go but, you know, down to the younger population. Mike Mendenhall, how does the eligibility criteria change impact businesses within the community? Are you hearing that businesses are asking their employees to get vaccinated, or they continue to let that be a personal choice?
I mean, I think for the most part, businesses are going to let that be a personal choice. You know, and a lot of it depends on the business owner. You know, I mean, if the businesses have kind of inspired a culture within their walls of masking and social distancing, you know, throughout the pandemic, I think you're going to see more of a sense of urgency amongst the employees and possibly a feeling of comfort in getting that vaccine. So there is that, you know, and you know, we're kind of seeing too, you know, there's not a lot that right now in Florida that businesses can do to make sure that their customers have been vaccinated. You know, Governor DeSantis is kind of pushing back against this idea that's coming out of the Biden administration of vaccine passports, you know, which would allow businesses to say, hey, I'd like to, you know, see proof of vaccination before, you know, any type of employee or customer comes in to the business. So, you know, there, as far as employees are concerned, I think it's really going to depend on that culture that's been built up in that business over the last year.
Yeah, because we're hearing now that Rutgers University is requiring all students who are going to be returning to class in the fall to become vaccinated. How long, David, do you think that's going to begin to trickle its way down to other states and other communities, which is probably why you know, the governor is drawing a line when it comes to vaccine passports?
Well, that's an interesting question. I really don't know how that's going to play out. You know, clearly there are maybe some big venues where you have a lot of people all crowded in together, and it would probably be, from a public health standpoint, a good thing if everybody in there had already gotten both shots and they're fully vaccinated. But I have a hard time seeing that actually come into play. First of all, I think there'd be a great black market for these fake passports. Last I heard, there was something called fake IDs that teenagers use to buy alcohol. So I just think it'd be very cumbersome, hard to do. There are maybe some privacy concerns about it. So I just don't really see a case where everybody's going to have a vaccine passport in their wallet and they're going to carry it around. And there's some places they won't need it and some places they do, and they'll show that off. It just doesn't seem to me like that's something that's really going to fly. But, then you have these cases where, as you mentioned, the colleges may require it, in the same way that you have to show it when you go to when you go through K-12 education, or the military requires it. So maybe for some of these, something where it's not just a one-off thing, but something where you're actually going day in and day out, and that would be a condition of going there. I can see something like that happen. It could be employers would require it in some cases, and maybe do some incentives for the employees to get it done.
Yeah, it's not uncommon for colleges and universities to require vaccinations before students move into the dorms or attend, or they can complete their registration. And we understand that Nova Southeastern University is requiring, and South Florida is requiring that as well. So it's actually happening. It just hasn't made its way all the way through all of the post-secondary education systems as yet. And because people they're going to be congregated in those settings, administration is going to want to try to provide as much protection as possible for students and staff. The number to call here, if you'd like to join us, 549-2937. I'm Charles Griggs. This is First Coast Connect, and we're in the middle of our Friday media roundtable, and we're currently discussing vaccines and, of course, the rising cases here recently here in Florida. Florida reported 6,790 new COVID-19 cases on Thursday. That's a daily spike not seen since March. So, there are some issues here. Everything is very complicated. Mike Mendenhall, do you see that the spike here is going to have any influence at all on how we turn the corner on this? Because we've got vaccines going almost at full strength here come Monday. And then we got mass, people opening up and mass mandates being lifted and more businesses opening up and communities opening up. How does this all play in this fight to mitigate this pandemic?
I think that, the rising cases, I think it's going to depend on how much it rises. I think it's also going to depend on the overall health impacts from a public health standpoint. If hospitalizations start to rise, if we start to see another rise in debt in COVID-19 related deaths, I think that will definitely spark some public outcry or public pressure on policymakers to reinstate some of those restrictions. But a lot of it's really going to depend on just the severity of the infections and how much it takes on, because there is pandemic fatigue out there. A lot of people are starting to they're tired of the restrictions, and so to kind of go backward, I think would be difficult. But I think that a lot of it's really going to depend, like I said, on just how severe any type of surge would be.
Yeah, that's the fine line politicians walk on this during this pandemic, sort of balancing science and the need of the community, people who want to live and have a normal lifestyle. Ann Schindler, how do you see that? I mean, will anyone be brave enough or crazy enough to go back and maybe perhaps find a way to reinstitute some of the restrictions that if this spike continue?
It's become, unfortunately, really politicized. And it's interesting, talking about the vaccination passports or just requiring vaccinations. I had to go and get an updated vaccination form for my son, who's going to be doing some athletics at college next year. And so we had to go get a new meningitis booster. And then they provided us a list of all of the vaccines he's had since he was born. And my husband was looking at it and joking that he was like a human pincushion. But it speaks to the fact that this is so rote. You know, we get so many vaccines from the time that we're born, except for a very small fraction of anti-vaxxers. I mean, we're very accustomed to getting polio vaccinations or smallpox or, you know, meningitis. We don't even think about it. And I think that this will become that at some point. It's probably going to become less politicized as we become more accustomed to living with it. And it'll be, I think, it's already being less politicized, I think, now that we have a new administration that isn't using, you know, a divisive language around the use of masks and even the existence or the way that it spreads. So I do think that it's going to become much more part of our common existence to get these vaccines, to get them as they emerge and evolve, as new variants come about. I think Dr. Fauci has said, you know, we don't probably hope to eradicate this. We hope to control it. So it's probably going to be more like just seasonal flu shots. Some people are going to get them, some people won't, and we'll try to, you know, tamp down the overall spread.
Yeah. David Barlin, what do you think about the chatter now that's going on? Many people have been vaccinated early on in the first wave, back in late December, early January, perhaps early February. And now health experts are saying that the vaccine typically will last, once you've been fully vaccinated, 6 to 8 months or so. And so what does that mean to us trying to achieve herd immunity in a situation where, you know, people believe that have been, you know, sort of convinced that once they receive the vaccine, they don't have to worry about it any longer. And so that's why they want to express their freedom.
Yeah, it's more like the flu vaccine than it is like some of the vaccines that perhaps we got in our childhood. It's something that will have to be done, rinse and repeat. Probably every year you'd have to go get another vaccine. Now, perhaps over time they'll develop a vaccine that lasts longer, but it does not appear likely that there's going to be a one and done vaccine where you get it, and then that's lifetime protection from the worst effects of catching the virus, the COVID-19 virus. So it's going to become a way of life in the same way the flu vaccine is. Now, the flu vaccine really isn't a requirement of that you see out there as a public health requirement. It's something people are greatly urged to do, and there's a lot of effort and free shots and that kind of thing. So it's going to be more like that than it is, I think, like some of the, say, the polio vaccine. But the reality is that because this vaccine wears off over time, if there is not a, if people start to sort of stop getting the renewal shots, then you do have a case where there's fresh ground once again for the virus to spread, because the virus is not going away. It's part of the public health ecosystem. And the pandemic will end when the spread of that virus drops below a certain point, but it's still going to be spreading even then. It's just going to be at a very, very low rate. And once people are, again, vulnerable to it, it'll pick up again. That's the basic science of how it works.
Yeah. And there are many more impacts related to the spread of the COVID-19 virus. One of those, the main one, the big one, is the economic livelihood of our communities across the country. Some good news surrounding that for Jacksonville residents struggling to pay their bills right now. The city made federal funds available to Duval County residents who haven't been able to pay their mortgage or their rent or utility bills due to a loss of income related to COVID-19 through two separate programs this week. Mike Mendenhall, you know, how does this impact? Is this right on time, or were people, because we're hearing numbers around employment rate, that employment rates are getting better, but there's still a lot of people out there struggling. How does this mix, and how does this help with those people who have been struggling to pay their rent?
Yeah, Charles, I mean, it is welcome relief to those people that have been struggling to pay their rent. And I think for, you know, just for economists and for the economy as a whole, it's a relief that this kind of aid is out there, because they were, economists were predicting, you know, a crisis when it comes to housing, when it comes to evictions. And which really could have had a large impact on our economic rebound. So these kind of issues, you know, are, you know, this kind of aid is definitely welcome. And, you know, there was a moratorium on evictions, both, in Florida and nationwide, but, you know, we've been hearing reports of some, you know, some landlords, you know, not following through with that, or not holding that up, you know. If and of course it took the tenant, you know, to actually start that process and apply for that, you know, for that moratorium from eviction. But this is also going to it's actually also going to benefit landlords, because, you know, landlords are, you know, have had issues with their tenants not paying their rent, and when those tenants don't pay their rent, then those landlords can't pay the mortgages that they have on those properties. And so it really starts a bad economic cycle.
Yeah. Ann Schindler, the city has made this program fairly easy to access and to provide benefit to residents. It seems very timely for people who are not only trying to make ends meet, but, you know, people who are trying to deal with the trauma of COVID-19, because it is, you know, something that is wider, it is more than just a health condition. How do you think that people are responding to this right now? Have you heard that people are actually, you know, using the program, and how, you know, and if they are they finding it very helpful?
Well, people are using the program, and people are keyed up to apply for some of these available benefits. You know, there's going to be some $30 million, you know, infusion of aid for people who are either behind on rent, mortgages, or utility bills. And part of that, you know, it helps the city. I mean, obviously, JEA is a city-owned utility, and so if people aren't paying that, the city's dividend that they get annually from that utility is diminished. And it's a stability issue. I think that, you know, you've been hearing lately people saying that the era of big government being over is over, and you're seeing that in a lot of ways. People are realizing that safety nets are only work if they work. You know, things like our unemployment system, which proved to be a huge failure, is going to be revamped the current legislative session in Tallahassee. They've already approved raising, although not by a ton, you know, by $100 or so, available unemployment benefits. But this pandemic has really taught us how close a lot of us are to the edge. You know, anybody that has lost a job this year, those of us that were furloughed, you realize that you know, the lifestyle that you live, your ability to pay your bills timely, really is, you know, it's a fragile network of things going right. And a lot went wrong this year for a lot of people. So I think that there's a growing recognition on all levels, state, federal, local, that there is benefit in having a government system that is, you know, a true safety net for people in crisis.
Yeah, and the city's recently sent out an update saying as of 4 p.m. yesterday, 3,321 residents applied for emergency rent or utility assistance, and 542 residents applied for mortgage relief. But funding is still available for both programs, with the mayor saying we must do what we can to help those affected financially because of the virus. So the city still has money available, and for those people who are who need relief, they can look up COJ.net and get more information about that. So we know that the plan is working, the program is working, people are applying for it, the money is still there. And they are taking applications until 6 p.m. on Friday, April 9th. So they can apply in person or online. So 549-2937, if you'd like to give us a call. This is our Friday Media Roundtable with Ann Schindler, Mike Mendenhall, and David Bauerlein. And as we discuss the news of the week, and we're right now discussing some of the city's relief program for people who need assistance and other issues. And COVID-19 is a real issue here and not across the country, because people are still trying to get their arms around whatever it's going to take in order to us to get rid of this virus or go get back to normal, as they say. You know, and then we're trying to live things, I guess, get our lives back together as normal. And there are a lot of other things going on that kind of keep us entertained. Some other news on our radar this week. Let's start with the Jacksonville Icemen, who announced plans for redevelopment of the Jacksonville Ice and Sports Complex early this week. They're going to be spending money to renovate the facility, make it into a nice $18 million conversion for the complex, and make it have a Hall of Fame in there and a place where the Icemen can enjoy and the community can enjoy some good hockey. David Barreline, what does this mean economically to the city, to people who enjoy hockey? You know, we've had several runs with hockey teams, and this one seems to be hanging in there and providing some valuable entertainment to folks in the community.
Yeah, it could be a good boost for the city. Beyond having a here, which is nice variety for watching sports, but also this could be a way to create tournaments that bring in youth to play here, and youth sports. You know, have it where if kids want to start lacing up the hockey skates when they're 4 or 5 years old, the same way they go out to a soccer field and play soccer, then they can start from an early age and really make that their thing. So it's a good deal. I mean, I know when the Lizard Kings were, that was a previous team, they moved from the arena to that skating rink off of Phillips Highway, and it really was a downscale. I mean, I remember going there and just feeling like it was, it was just like walking into a much scaled down version of what you would think hockey would be like. In this case, it sounds like they're really going to upgrade it, make it much nicer. It's just wild to me in some sense that here in Florida, hockey is becoming a thing, and maybe a sport that youth are playing in the same way they play some of the outdoor sports. And it kind of shows that it does travel. Even if it's a 95 degrees in the middle of summer, you can go to the hockey rink and learn to skate and play hockey. So that's probably a good thing. It sounds like a good program.
Yeah, it sounds like based upon the scale of projects that we've heard, economic development projects we've heard in the past, this one is not a lot of money in context. It says under the agreement, the money would be appropriated in the form of $6.5 million loan for the team and $1 million project completion grant to the Icemen. Doesn't seem like a lot for the investment to have this type of entertainment for the Spring Park area, and maybe a draw for people over there. Mike Mendenhall, have you spoken? I know you're covering this area of business. This seems like a pretty good deal and pretty good balance of investment on both sides.
I mean, the city's going to get a small return on the investment, you know, from a money standpoint. But, you know, I think that, one of the goals of, you know, the city's public investment policy is to grow, ancillary economic development. So whenever you're bringing in people from outside of Northeast Florida to patronize, to go to some of these youth hockey events, they're going to be spending dollars here. They're going to be, they're going to be staying in the hotels, So, I mean, it does. It brings a further economic benefit both to local businesses and to city coffers. And, it's interesting because when the Icemen, they proposed this, one of the things that they noted is that there are youth hockey leagues or youth hockey traveling tournaments all over the southeastern U.S. and that, people are, these families are bypassing Jacksonville to go to other cities in Florida that have facilities that can, that can handle these kind of things. So this is really, it'll be a shorter traveling distance for some of those, some of those families and some of those traveling tournaments are hoping that'll be a draw there. And, this area of Jacksonville, needs a little bit of economic boost, a little bit of injection of capital. So I think that both from the Icemen from an investment standpoint in the city, see this as a win.
Yeah, Ann Schindler, it looks like they're planning on partnering with various youth organizations like the Boys and Girls Club to teach children how to skate and play hockey. People can see that this is something pretty much worth investing in. How does this shape up in terms of context and concept to some of the other investments that we've seen public funds be allocated towards?
Well, I think it's an interesting observation, like you said, that this is seems a lot more affordable compared to the other sports endeavors that the city is, you know, paid to finance. I also think it's going to be a really important redevelopment for that area. You know, it has been, I remember when it was kind of like South Metro, you know, redevelopment. It's been a difficult climb for some parts of that, what do you call it, East San Marco area or whatever, to succeed, mm-hmm. you know. But as San Marco's footprint grows and as the property there becomes more valuable and more people want to live there, I think you're going to see more improvement and more options. Frankly, I think it's interesting that they've got, you know, one of the centerpieces of this two new, you know, rinks, blah, 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 is a bar. So I think parents whose kids are playing, you know, late in the afternoon hockey or, you know, may have a greater incentive to go and watch and participate too, because it'll give them, you know, some dining options as well. So I think it's going to be a positive for that area. And I also think it's going to be just fun for kids. Hockey and skating is something they don't have a ton of opportunity to do previously and otherwise in Florida.
Yeah, have alcohol, we'll travel, right? That's what they say. They expect for the project to be completed in August of 2022. And, you know, they may have some delays, but it sounds like fun. I'm not a big hockey fan, but I would certainly, you know, come out and enjoy myself on an evening where it's good, clean fun. So in other news, there seems to be a controversial festival that may be headed to Jack's Beach this summer. It looks like a festival called the Orange Crust Festival is planned for the beach in June 18th through the 20th. David Bauline, the Times Union, reported on this. What makes this festival so controversial, and what could be the possible impacts of it?
So I assume the controversy is that there were some, it was, I think, in Savannah area previously, and there were just some issues in terms of enforcing some of the local policies for just regulating crowds and gatherings and that kind of thing. So, from what I've read, it sounds like these are, they're college students on spring break, you know, and sometimes the controversy is just that that's not a culture mix. It always works for some beach communities. It'll be different for the beaches here. I mean, it's not really known as a place where college students end up going, like, say, Daytona or Pensacola and South and the Panhandle beaches. So it's just going to be an interesting in terms of how that mix goes, because it's a little bit of a slower pace at these beaches than some of these other sort of go-go spring break environments are. So I don't know that it's necessarily going to be real controversial, but it will be a difference in terms of just the general maybe atmosphere at the beach possibly.
Yeah, according to the story, it says it's been on the Tybee Island beach near Savannah for several years, but organizers say they relocated due to civil rights violations and political injustices. Mike Mendenhall, what would make this area any more any better if those were some concerns? It seemed like maybe festival organizers would want to work with local organizers in the area where they traditionally held the event and try to make things better.
Yeah, I mean, according to the article in the Florida Times Union, the festival organizers have said on their social media that Jacksonville has agreed, to allow this festival. The city, I believe, of Jacksonville Beach was saying that they haven't filed a permit, but they are allowed to hold an event on the beach as long as it's not ticketed, it's not, you know, for an income driven purpose. I think the toughest thing for this festival is going to be the fact that Duval County beaches are dry. They don't allow open container, you know, public consumption of alcohol on the beaches. So, you know, for any type of festival, whether it's a music festival, whether it's a, you know, any type of festival, it's going to involve kind of partying, I guess, if you will, that could be that could be a tough sell for the festival goers. So I think that's going to be a level of concern. And you know, Duval County beaches are, you know, patronized pretty heavily by local residents. So you know, we'll just have to see as the festival gets closer if you know these organizers, you know, reach out and start working with these local city halls over in the beaches.
Yeah, and speaking of civil rights violations, Ann Schindler, your station is reporting, First Coast News, that a woman is suing Publix after being accused of shoplifting, tased in the parking lot in front of children. Tawanda Crowell ended up spending 24 hours in jail, even after officers say the receipt showing she purchased the items. You know, she ended up in jail, even though, how does this look with JSO? And, you know, what did you see in terms of the story that, is this confusion on the JSO's part, or is it did Ms. Crowell actually do something wrong?
Well, no, the charges that were initially going to be filed against her, or what she was arrested under, were never filed. The state attorney's office dropped the charges, and that's because she went in and bought some deli chicken and some Hawaiian rolls, and she paid for them, and she had a receipt for them. And for some reason, the manager of the Publix told that officer who was working there off-duty to follow her out, and this confrontation ensued. Interestingly, I think, is that the lawsuit is specific to Publix, and it's, you know, accusing them of not training their people properly and not doing enough to train this officer or to look into his background. But JSO isn't mentioned, and yeah, They're not a target. And I think that that's interesting as well, because, you know, he's a JSO officer. The body camera that he was wearing is JSO issued body cam. The footage that was released came from JSO. It's not like they're an uninvolved party. Certainly the optics are pretty bad. I mean, the officer, you know, acknowledges on his own body cam as he's sort of walking away from the scene where the woman has been tased and placed in a squad car. And one of the tasers, I mean, not too delicate a point, you know, hit her in the genital area. So it was not like a, you know, kind of haphazard incident for her. It was, you know, kind of a deal. But as he's walking back to the Publix, he's seeing the receipt, you know, acknowledging, he's like, why didn't she show me this? She, you know, basically she did pay for this, but she still was in custody throughout that next many hours. So I would guess, I mean, this suit is not just filed. It was filed last year. I think the news of it was the release of the body camera footage. And the announcement, you know, Benjamin Crump has taken on the case, at least, you know, making it more public, and was in town speaking to it. So that's kind of why it's just in the news right now.
But certainly it's difficult
optics. It's just not a very good incident. The woman clearly was wrongly accused of shoplifting. And, you know, she had her daughter and a couple of her nieces with her. So this all happened in front of three children who are under the age of 13.
Yeah. That brings us back to the body cam issue, because it sounds like if the reason why this is news is because of the body cam footage. Other than that, it would have been, maybe perhaps the lawsuit would not have been able to be brought without it. Do you think that's accurate, David Bauerlein?
I think I got your question, Charles. I mean, obviously, yeah, the body cam footage, it's a great development in order to be able to actually see it for oneself, as opposed to the he said, she said type of reports where people remember things differently, perhaps people leave information out. So yeah, I think the body cam footage in this case is going to be really important. And it's just interesting how that has become more and more a part of these types of reviews of how police go about doing their jobs.
Yeah, it is interesting, because it is one of the things that people were talking about in terms of how quickly information becomes public, and it becomes made public for, you know, to be able to tell the entire story. And here we see, like Ann mentioned, that this was something that occurred a while back and may have played a role in where we are today within the lawsuit. So, yeah. So anyway, I want to thank all of you all for joining me today. This has been great for helping me out with sitting in with Melissa, filling in for Melissa Ross. Thanks, David, Ann, and Mike for being here.
Great being with you, Charles.
All right. In a moment.
Thank you, Charles.
Yes, thank you. And in a moment, we're going to have a preview of violinist Midori Gatto's upcoming performance in Amelia Island. We'll be right back.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. It's the number one killer of teens. One text or call can wreck it all. Let's put an end to distracted driving.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
Generation W presents our 10th anniversary event, Intentional 2021, April 16th in a virtual format. Experience this one-day leadership event with speakers who will inspire you to live and work with intention. Registration is online at genwnow.com.
This week on Science Friday, we're celebrating spring by talking about the pollinating personalities of flies, beetles, and some messy pollinators.
Are they slobs like the moths that I study? They have pollen dangling all over their extremities and they dangle 1,000 pollen grains on the next flower.
Plus, if you want to be a beekeeper, we've got the guides. All on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. She's one of the most famous and renowned violinists in the world. Midori Gatto is coming to Amelia Island on April 9th. Then next month, in May, she'll be honored at the Kennedy Center. Melissa Ross got a preview of this special concert from Eric Sakuri, director of the Amelia Island Chamber Music Festival.
Hi, Eric. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Melissa. It's truly my pleasure to be on your show. And thanks for this opportunity to discuss what's going on with Midori in our community.
Yes, Midori is, of course, being honored this spring at the Kennedy Center, along with other huge performers like Garth Brooks and Debbie Allen. So she'll get that award in May. But in April, you are very excited because she's coming to perform on Amelia Island at the Chamber Music Festival. Tell us about that.
Yes, absolutely. First of all, Midori Gatto, that's her last name officially, is one of the most renowned classical violinists in the world, and she will perform in Amelia Island on April 9th as part of the Amelia Island Chamber Music Festival. Now, Midori is an amazing violinist. She started when she was 3 in Japan and made her debut with the New York Philharmonic at age 11. Ever since then, she's been performing and teaching all over the world. And now in May, as you mentioned, she'll be an honoree of the prestigious Kennedy Center Honors, along with Joan Baez, Debbie Allen, Dick Van Dyke, and Garth Brooks.
Mm.
And we're so honored to be able to present her in April as part of our 20th season.
Yeah, your 20th season of the Amelia Island Chamber Music Festival. And as people are slowly inching back into coming out to see live performances, tell us about your COVID protocols for this event.
Yeah, we have, of course, following the requirements placed by the local organizations. And we are keeping, for instance, this concert. This concert will be held at the Amelia Island Plantation Chapel. And typically, their capacity is about 420, but we expect to have about 100 at the location, mm-hmm. keeping the social distancing.
Sure. So a distanced audience, but it's got to be exciting to see a return to live performances after a year of virtual ones or cancellations.
Exactly. In fact, we had a first in-person concert last weekend, and we had a very small audience, but it was so enlightening to have an in-person concert for the audience and the musicians, too, and we had lots of feedback on that as well.
Now, getting back to Midori, she's truly a prodigy. So this is a unique opportunity to see this performer. Tell us a little bit more about her unique talents.
Okay. So she was, as you said, a child prodigy. And when she was three, she started to play violin. And she really amazed famous people like Pinchas Zukerman, et cetera, at the age of 11 when she came to the U.S. And that they just could not believe her talent. And ever since then, she just kept performing. And she's been also focusing on music education as well. And she is teaching at the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia as well.
So, again, if you're hankering to get out to hear some beautiful music, check out Midori coming up, a live performance courtesy of the Amelia Island Chamber Music Festival.
Yes.
Get your tickets at their website, Amelia Chamber Music, or AICMF.com. This is two concerts, right, Eric? One at the chapel in the afternoon and then another one in the evening?
Yeah, exactly the same thing, because we had to keep, because of the COVID concern, we cannot have intermissions, so we're keeping it very short, about a little bit over an hour, and then repeat the concert at 7 p.m. as well on the same day.
So go see Midori on Amelia Island before she receives the Kennedy Center honors in May. Check it out. Get your tickets now. Eric Sakurai, Executive Director at the Amelia Island Chamber Music Festival. Have a great time. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the opportunity.
That's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and listeners for this and callers today. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Thank you, Josh. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. If you have any questions or comments about First Coast Connect, send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Charles Griggs, and I'm sitting in for Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be back on Monday, but if you missed anything, you can listen to our rebroadcast at 8 p.m. and find today's show on wjct.org. and your favorite podcast platform. Have a great Easter weekend. Thank you.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.